Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and really pleased to welcome Sarah Dykeman to our program. In 2017, she traveled from Mexico to Canada and then back to Mexico following the monarch butterfly migration. And today she'll share her journey with us. If you've been reading along with us, you'll know that her book is the latest on our book club list. And the book's titled Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. We came up with this book club idea so you'd get a chance to read the books before we talk with the authors, and I hope many of you have today. And if you did, what'd you enjoy about the book? Are you working to help save monarchs? And whether or not you've read the book, I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments about monarchs and about Sarah's trip. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Dykeman, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, and thanks for reading my book. I'm super excited to be here.
I tell you what, it was a very, very fun, interesting read, because I learned a lot about monarchs, and I also learned a lot about traveling a long distance on a bicycle. It's hard to believe that you made this. Well, I guess it's hard to believe maybe somebody hasn't done it before, but it was such a great idea, I thought. What inspired you? Here you are, an amphibian researcher, really, by training.
Well, I love all animals. I especially love underdogs. I love the unappreciated animals. And often insects go unnoticed. And monarchs, even though people love them, they're in our backyards and we don't know they're there. They're crossing over our schools and over our daily commutes and we don't know they're there. So calling to attention the beauty that's in our own backyard is really important to me. And it just happened that the monarch was like the perfect traveling companion. There's a lot of animals out there that I'd love to study more of, but they don't go about 50 miles a day. They don't spread out so that I can choose lots of different roads. They're not the easiest to follow on a bicycle, but the monarch was the perfect storm of possibility. So along I went.
Along you went, and it was a great trip. It had to be for you. I was thinking about my own longest bicycling trip, which was 500 miles in over a six-day period. And I had a bike that you could lift with your little finger, and there was a sag vehicle, and there were other people there with me. And I was feeling pretty good about myself. And then I read your book. You're on a 70-pound, or a bike that, with everything on it, weighs 70 pounds.
The key is slow and steady. Slow and steady. I never went fast. My joke was I was slower than a butterfly, but faster than a caterpillar, because it was always slow, but slow and steady.
Well, let's talk about the start of your trip. It was interesting to me that you spent about, 6 weeks or so in Mexico, sort of getting ready for the trip. Talk about that experience.
Yeah, I went to Mexico with not much of a plan other than that I knew I wanted to head off with the monarchs in early March. And I went and I didn't really have any idea of what to expect. And when I showed up at one of the biggest colonies called El Rosario, I met a guide. You have to have a guide to visit the monarchs there. And it was a wonderful coincidence that my guide was Brianda, who has become a good friend. And after our trip to see the monarchs that first time, I was invited to stay at her house so I could come back and learn more. And I ended up living with her for about 4 weeks that first time. And I've been back subsequent years, and she's like a sister now. So I'm so grateful that the monarchs kind of introduced that world to me.
Rita in Middleton has a comment for us. Let's go there right away. Rita, hi.
Hi, Larry and Sarah. I'm talking to two of my favorite heroes, and you, neither one of you know who I am. Well, Sarah, you might remember me. I don't know. But Larry, your shows are my favorite on public radio. And Sarah, I met Sarah in 2020 in February. I was on a butterfly trip with Kylie Baumley. And we were on a bus going to Al Rosario Sanctuary, and Kylie said to us, I've got the best surprise for you. I've got the best surprise for you. And we're wondering, what is this all about? So the bus stops, and in jumps Sarah to join our tour and to help show us where the monarchs overwinter. And Sarah, your book is awesome. I've been recommending it to everybody I know. And Larry, you have to know that Sarah is gracious and kind and passionate and humble. And we just learned so much from her. And I do raise monarchs and just continue to do so and try to spread the word to people to plant milkweed. And, you know, it's such a wonderful experience of nature, and we need to really work on saving the monarchs. So, hi, Sarah. Merry Christmas.
Thanks. Thank you. It's fun to kind of come full circle. And that was my first ever, like, talk on a moving bus. And it's harder to give a presentation on a moving bus, I must say. But, yeah, I love the connections monarchs make, right? Like, I've met all these people because of the monarch. I've met them in Mexico and along my journey, of course. And the connections continue to be made. And I think it's a great reminder the monarchs give us that we are all connected. And we're connected by these migrating insects, which I think is really beautiful. So thanks for reading and passing on the word and taking care of monarchs. It's good to know we're part of a team.
Yeah, thank you, Reed. Appreciate it. You can join in too, by the way, 800-642-1234. Give us a call. I wonder, you were kind of guiding there on the bus, but let's go back to those guides for just a minute, because I thought that was a really interesting, I mean, these guides are taking you to these sanctuaries, and maybe just explain a little about that process, because there's a sort of a delicate balance there of wanting to maintain the sanctuaries and helping local folks make some income from it. Talk about that.
Right. Yeah, when you think of a national park in the United States, you think of this land that doesn't have a lot of development and doesn't have people living on the land, not anymore at least. And in Mexico, that's not the case. The Monarch Butterfly Biosphere Reserve, people live there. And prior to the protection of that land, it was people's livelihood, that they would cut the forest and harvest the wood, and that's how they made their living. And then it became a protected area for monarchs. And so we need to come up with new ways for people to make their living. And it is this delicate balance, as you say, and it's not perfect yet. And there's still a lot that needs to be done in order to bring equality and justice for everyone and sustainability, not just for the monarch, but for the people too. But one of the solutions is ecotourism. And a lot of the people, when you go visit the public sanctuaries, which includes El Rosario and Sierra Chinqua and Cerro Pelon, those are the probably the most popular three, that you are accompanied by a local guide. And this is really important, because not only do they get an income, but they're also seeing how much people love the monarch, and that passion is contagious, of course. So it's definitely really important that you go with a local guide and give them a tip if you can afford it, because that's their livelihood. And for a lot of the guides, there's a lot of interesting rules with land use and permitting and stuff. But you typically can only guide once every 3 years, and it's not everyone. So, and it's only for a short time. So it's not exactly stable work.
So one of those guides, you have to remember, as you point out in the book, that when you think about the tip, because they're only going to get to do this once every 3 years. And so you might want to fatten the tip up a little bit when if you're there and you have a chance to talk with them. Well, you got underway. You were there about 6 weeks or so, and then you got underway and off to a little bit of a rough start.
Yeah, I mean, that's what an adventure is, right? If it's smooth, then you're doing something wrong because the stories emerge from all of the misturns. And I ran into, there's so many speed bumps in Mexico. I hit a speed bump. I must have been going 40 miles an hour. And boy, howdy, all the stuff came off my bike. And it was very early on in the trip. And I just like looked around. And I was like, oh, I'm so glad that no cars are going by because this is pretty embarrassing right now. And then the other embarrassing thing was the like literally the first turn, like I knew all the roads nearby, but when I kind of left the places I was familiar with, I came to an intersection, first intersection that I didn't know. And I definitely realized about an hour in that I had gone the wrong way. And it's just like, of course I have this 9 month trip planned, this 10,000 mile trip planned, and I've already gotten lost. So but it all worked out. It was kind of meant to be sometimes.
And that was your kind of your plan was to sort of wing it anyway, which is an interesting philosophy on something like this. Talk a bit about the advantages of winging it. All right, so there was maybe a little disadvantage, but I think near the end of the book you come back to that and say, "Hey, it was a good experience anyway."
Exactly. I think if you plan everything, then you kind of shut yourself off to all the really wonderful surprises that can happen when you're traveling. So on my trip, I had general idea of where I wanted to go, and there were certain spots I knew I wanted to stop at, certain invitations that I'd said yes to. But in between, I didn't know where I was going to sleep every night. I didn't know where I was going to get my food, but I knew I would figure it out. And sometimes that meant having to bike a few more hours longer than I wanted. But it also meant that if I was on the side of the road in Mexico and someone said, "Hey, I live across the street and I'm having a bus or a party with my family. Do you want to come?" Because I hadn't arranged a spot already, I was in the perfect situation to say yes. And one of my rules when I'm traveling is try and say yes as much as possible. Say yes as long as you feel safe, because that is where the stories are. That's what you remember. And often, I mean, 10,000 miles, they all kind of run together and bleed together, and I can't remember one from another. But I remember, of course, staying with those people, and I remember those moments where I said yes.
Susan in Twin Lakes has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Susan. Oh, we lose Susan? Oh, I'm sorry, we lost her. Well, she had a story to tell, I believe, and it kind of relates to part of your book too. She was taking milkweed and putting it in cornfields or along cornfields. And she was commenting that the birds use the seeds for nesting and so forth. But that whole business of cornfields and wheat fields or whatever comes into play as you make your journey.
Right. I mean, when next time you're out and about, notice all the cornfields and recognize that at one point that was all prairie and that was all the monarch home. And there's an interesting story with the milkweed and the monarch. And for folks that don't know, milkweed is the only food source of the monarch caterpillar. And it used to grow all around the prairie. And so as the monarchs were migrating, they would lay their eggs on this milkweed, and then the caterpillars would eat the milkweed, and the cycle would continue. And what happened is we started converting all the prairie to corn fields. And for a while that was fine because there was this great thing that happened where a lot of milkweed are disturbance species, so they thrive in disturbed areas. So as the prairie was disturbed by the plow, then there would be corn growing and milkweed. And it was this really great opportunity to see how we can share. And the milkweed really did thrive. But what happened is that GMOs were introduced. And so instead of not being able to spray the cornfields because you would kill the corn, all of a sudden there was this new strain of corn where you could spray for herbicides and the corn would be okay, but everything else would die. And just overnight, that meant all of the fields that used to be able to be a home for the monarch no longer could be. So one of the important things when I was biking was recognizing like how much of the land that used to be for the monarchs is no longer. And then recognizing all the places where we can change that, where we can return some of the prairie back to the monarchs and we can learn to share.
And you say in the book that the prairie has been is as important as those overwintering forests for the monarchs.
Right. Yes, this is such another great thing that the monarch teaches us, is that the monarch is North American. It isn't just an issue for Mexico to change what they're doing in order to protect the monarch. And it's not just the United States that needs to change to protect the monarch, or Canada. It's all three countries need to come together. And so in Mexico, they have different responsibilities. They need to take care of the forests in Mexico and plant lots of plants on the fall migration route so the monarchs have fuel for the winter. But in the United States, we need to plant milkweed. And we can have the most protected, best forest in Mexico, but if there's no milkweed in the United States and Canada, then the migration falls apart. So every single person has a role to play. And one of my favorite things on my trip was, I didn't actually see a monarch every day, but every single day, every single person I saw my entire trip, every single person has a role to play, and every person can help. And I think that's just so wonderful that we can be part of this team, and that we can learn what it's like to be part of something bigger than ourselves and plant some milkweed and make a difference.
Sarah Dykeman, our guest today, she is the author of Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us with your questions to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer for today's show. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking today with Sarah Dykeman about her book, Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201-Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. And you can join in again, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. You know, at some point that you, well, more than once, you through the book, you talk about how the population of monarchs over the last, I don't know, generations has really declined and is, and it's serious.
Exactly, yeah. And that's one of the important facets of my bike tour, was to call to attention that. And the main reason for the monarch declines is habitat loss. If you have no place to raise your young, then there's going to be less monarchs, of course. And a female monarch will lay about 500 eggs. And she wants to lay about one per milkweed, because if she laid 500 on one milkweed plant, well, the milkweed would be decimated in minutes. So she tries to lay one per milkweed, which means if there's millions and millions of female monarchs, then we need billions of milkweeds. And so as you take those away, you take away the possibility for the next generation to be robust. So again, it's what's so amazing about the monarch is that it offers us this opportunity to join and be part of the solution immediately, which is go out, find some local milkweed, plant it in your yard, along with some native nectar plants, of course, because the adults need to drink nectar as well. And then hopefully we can get that population to rebound.
And the whole part about the sex part of it, I thought was quite interesting to me. You were talking about some males that were, and females that were maybe laying their eggs too close to their winter grounds, and that would spell not a good thing for those monarchs.
Yeah, there's some interesting ecology that happens at the overwintering sites. And what you'll see is in February, the temperature will warm up and the monarchs will become way more active. And then by March, they're starting to head north. And you'll see some monarchs mating. And what that is females can mate with multiple males and actually have their eggs fertilized by multiple males. But the females have to get to Texas. They have to get to the milkweed in order to be successful. So it doesn't really make sense to mate in Mexico unless you're a male and you think, I'm too skinny to make that long trek. I'm going to mate now, and maybe one of one of these females will be able to carry my DNA to Texas. So it's kind of a Hail Mary, and it's really interesting. But that's another interesting part of the migration, is that while they're in Mexico, they're not actually nectaring. They're not actually drinking much nectar. There's not enough for all these monarchs. So they're relying on the nectar they drank during the fall migration. So they build up their fat reserves as they're flying to Mexico, and then they have to live off that fat until the spring. And if their fat starts to drain, if there weren't enough nectar plants on their route, they arrived too skinny, they're probably not going to make it back to Texas.
Yeah. Ron in Pioneer, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling.
For at least during the past 6 years, a cluster of milkweeds have produced seed. This fall, I harvested all the ones that hadn't opened yet and probably have 500 dry seeds. Should these be planted farther north than Madison so that the plants have a better chance of surviving with the climate that's going to be there in 10 and 20 and 30 years from now? Should we be planting whatever milkweed seed we can get in good soil sites, but 100 to 500 miles further north than where they grew naturally?
That's a great question. In Mexico, they're doing something similar where they're planting the OML fir trees. They're taking ones at lower elevation and moving them up the mountain, assuming that the lower elevation ones are more heat and drought tolerant, and they'll be better suited for climatic change. With the milkweed, since they're reproducing and creating seeds every year, I think that is less of an issue. But like you said, it is really important to plant the milkweed seeds kind of where you found them, or in the general vicinity. If they went a little north, that's okay. But those seeds are from the plants that were best suited for that area. So if you can, and this can be difficult if you're not in a spot that has lots of opportunities and nurseries and stuff like that, but if you can find the local seeds to plant, you can. You should do that with the local seeds and try and get native as much as possible. They're, because monarchs are becoming so well known and so beloved, it's getting easier and easier to find milkweed, but I'm sure your neighbors would love some of your seeds. Another note is that the milkweed seeds need to be cold stratified, so you can't just put them in the soil in the spring and they'll grow. You can do a little internet research, but they need to basically experience winter. So you either need to plant them in the fall so they can go through winter, or trick them into thinking it was winter by putting them in the refrigerator. But
yeah. And in your book, you I think it was maybe it was around the time you were in New York or thereabouts, you were talking about a problem of tropical milkweed. I think you make mention of some milkweed is not necessarily good for the monarchs.
There's lots and lots of native species of milkweed, so I encourage folks to pick native when they can. Tropical milkweed is a bit of a controversy in the monarch world, but there's a few issues, especially if you live in the south, because it doesn't die back the same way that native milkweed does if you live in a more temperate climate, and so there can be a buildup of OE, which is a prosome parasite. But if you live in the north, it will die back a little bit later because it's an annual plant in the north. So the milkweeds or the monarchs that are eating on these tropical milkweeds might think it's also complicated. But basically the milkweeds that develop in the fall on tropical milkweed might not emerge as in sexual diapause. They might be reproductive, which means they would mate and lay eggs on eggs that would freeze to death. So the takeaway for me, at least, is go native when you can. There's so many awesome species. If you have tropical milkweed and it's like you love that plant so much, I'm not gonna like knock on your door and pick a fight, but go native when you can.
And thinking about milkweed a bit more, on your way up, I think you were in Oklahoma, and it may be a result of climate change or whatever, but the monarchs were, if I'm not mistaken, maybe I'm getting this wrong, were arriving earlier than normal, and the milkweed wasn't yet, a lot of the milkweed wasn't yet mature enough for the monarchs.
Right. It's so amazing how every little detail of the migration lines up perfectly. And when you just change one little thing, like the arrival date, it can throw the whole system into whack. So in 2017, what happened was there were these winds that pushed the monarchs north early. And so they arrived to a place that the milkweed hadn't emerged. And so if a few had emerged, the monarchs were egg dumping, which means putting way too many eggs on the available milkweed. And at first you think, oh, they're going further north early. They're getting a head start. This is great. But what happens too is monarchs are cold-blooded. And so if it's a warm temperatures, the eggs and the caterpillars develop quickly, which is good, because then you can get more generations into the same amount of time, and you can double the population much quicker. But because they had gone so far north where the temperatures were colder, it was taking much longer for the eggs and caterpillars to develop. So we actually were losing a generation. And so it's just, everything is just so perfect. And I think we need to remember this as we fight for climate legislation, is like, we're tweaking things and we are just now just beginning to understand the implications and the effects. And when the whole system is out of whack, then that's bad for everyone, including humans.
Dennis emailed, he adopted monarch caterpillars and felt bad when some didn't survive. And he heard from you that in the wild, or other guests, that in the wild, many caterpillars die or are killed by predators. So he felt like he probably saved more than he lost. You think he's right?
Yeah. Well, so there's two things going on here that are interesting. So what he's doing is called rearing, where you take monarch eggs and then you rear them indoors, usually in Tupperware or nets, netted cages. And I think that this is great to do in small numbers. I think it's important for people to be able to connect with monarchs in this way and see a process that's often hidden from our view. And I think it's great so that you can invite your neighbors or the neighbor's kids over so that they can experience the monarchs too. But I think it's also important to be okay with some monarch eggs dying. That's how it is. If every monarch egg survived, we would have too many monarchs in the world. And so I like to remind people that if a female lays 500 eggs, only a few of those are going to survive. But that means there's going to be 498 meals for birds and spiders and frogs and all the other animals that depend on the intact food chain. So bring a few inside so you can enjoy the process, but then don't feel bad with some of them disappearing in your garden, because that's what we want. We want the monarchs to not just be healthy, but we want the whole system to be healthy.
Yeah. Somebody else was wondering, you, and I probably should have asked you to do this in the beginning, but the trail, more or less, that you took. Could you talk about that? It was kind of go back to the beginning here, looking at where you went and how you went along with the monarchs.
Right. So I left Michoacan, Mexico, in mid or early March, which is in the southern central Mexico, and I kind of headed straight up into Texas, and then I zigzagged quite a bit, but I ended up going through the Upper Peninsula and then into Canada. I did a very ridiculous eastern loop where I went all the way to the Atlantic Ocean when I visited New York City, and then I actually cruised back through New York back into Canada, and then pretty much back south. It was very convoluted, and when you see my route, and you can see my route on my website, that's beyondabook.org, but at pretty much every little twist or little detour is because of an invitation. So while I was biking, people were hearing about my trip, and they'd say, oh, I'm a teacher in Omaha. We have a butterfly garden. We'd love for you to come give a presentation. And I gave presentations to about 9,000 kids on my trip, and so I would look at my map and I would look at the numbers and I would think, can my body do this? And then I'd say, yes, as long as if it was physically possible, I'd say yes. And then I'd kind of detour my route in order to visit a school or a wildlife refuge or someone's house. And that accounts for all the twists and turns.
And the experiences, and you were, maybe talk about the equipment that you had on the trip and then sort of how you, well, not only for sustenance, but for presentations and probably for this book.
Yeah, I have an old steel frame mountain bike that I put together from used parts. I call it a combination of road sale or garage sale and I had a name for it, but it doesn't look beautiful. It's we call them beater bikes. They're not pretty to look at, but what they're great about is no one wants to steal them. So I could lean my bike up against a grocery store and be pretty confident it would be there when I got back. And then on my bike, I had these, they're called panniers or bike bags, and they were loaded down with everything I needed. And that included all my camping gear, so tent, sleeping bag, sleeping pad, all my cooking gear, as well as luxuries that you don't really need. Like I had a computer and a tripod and a camera. And those were all so that I could be networking and making connections and organizing presentations. And like I said, I gave lots of presentations on the way, which was kind of the point. The point of my trip was to be a voice for the monarch, to call to attention not only that their population is declining, but that we can all do something about it.
And it was interesting to me that where you would, if you were just out on the road in the country, you'd find a place where you could kind of hide off the road, put your tent up and more or less be hidden. But you also leaned a lot on churches.
I do. Yeah. Rural churches are great places to camp. They are usually not well visited, and people are pretty laid back about a visitor, at least a white female visitor, I must say. I don't know what the experience would be like if I wasn't a white woman, but it probably would have been much tougher to camp as I did. So that's certainly a privilege that I was afforded. But because I was not having much of a plan, usually about dusk, I would start looking, and I always found a camping spot. I tried to be as respectful as I could, and also just recognize that, like, this used to all be the prairie, and now it's all this private land, and I think maybe we need to rethink what that means, which I know is controversial.
Oh, but there, and, you know, those churches, they may have an outside spigot for some, you know, you can fill your water bottles. And
oh, the... yeah. When you're bike touring, this is the smallest thing that you get so excited about. So if there was a water spigot, wow, that's worth dancing about. If there was an electric outlet, wow, that's even better. If there's a flat spot or like a bush so that there's not like a giant light shining on you at night, really, really celebrate the small things.
Well, and maybe share an experience, not with the churches and so forth, but share an experience or two that you had with people that you just ran into, and they were kind enough to do many things for you, let you camp or feed you or whatever.
Yeah, I think I stayed with 67 families on my trip, which is a lot. And a lot of those found out about my trip beforehand, and we were kind of coordinating, and some of them were on the fly. And I'm actually reminded, I was in Buffalo, New York, and I had gone to a few churches, and it was just not quite rural enough. There were just too many people, and it just didn't feel right. And so I thought, well, I need to ask permission, because I can't just camp here. It's pretty much, at this point, was a city. And the church said no. And I was like, oh, and they could tell I was very defeated, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And then the woman in the parking lot was like, well, you can just stay at my house. And she lived pretty close. And we ended up going to her house, and I found a milkweed egg, or excuse me, not milkweed, a monarch egg and a monarch caterpillar on some milkweed that was kind of just in a weedy part of her yard. And I had planned to just leave the next morning really early, and instead I ended up staying for two more nights because this just, it was really wonderful. It was a great connection. And I certainly remember that more than if I had just gotten on my bike and started pedaling.
Oh man, for sure. Sarah Dykeman, our guest today, her book is Bicycling with Butterflies, My 10,201 Mile Journey Following the Monarch Migration. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to the Ideas Network.